Welcome to The Bookshelf. I'm Chris Messini. This is week two of our presentation of the 2020 Spokesman Review Summer Stories short fiction series. Each summer for the past 7 years, the Spokesman Review has published new short fiction by local authors in a special section of the Sunday newspaper. This year's theme was Mount St. Helens, in remembrance of that volcano's eruption on May 18th, 1980. Tonight's first story is by Deb Coletti. She's the author of 18 books for adults and young adults, including Honey Baby Sweetheart, a finalist for the National Book Award, and A Heart in a Body in the World, a Michael L. Prince honor book. Her books have also won the Josette Frank Award for Fiction, the Washington State Book Award, and numerous other state awards and honors. And she was a finalist for the Penn USA Award. Her first book for middle grade readers, A Flicker of Courage, was published in January, and her new young adult novel, Girl Unframed, was released in June. She lives in Seattle with her family. Here's Spokane Public Radio's Maureen Hager reading Deb Coletti's story, Volcanic.
Volcanic by Deb Coletti. We've heard rumblings for 2 months, news of little earthquakes, hundreds of them, explosions of steam, dark ash covering snow-clad summits. But let's be honest, I've heard rumblings for years. I know the signs. Shivering teacups as a hand smacks a table. Explosions of steam you can feel, the heat coming right off his skin. Dark ash, a mood edging in. A shift in the atmosphere, a foreboding that makes you step oh so carefully and turn the doorknobs oh so slowly. I felt eruptions too. Bad enough that I had to clap my hands over my ears from the sound. I wanted to run, but I couldn't, so I hid instead, though his rage always found me. Forget it, we're not going. Not when this place is worth $60,000 at least. Sean downs the last of his coffee, sets the cup on the deck. This place, our cabin, our home, right down the road from the lodge at Harmony Falls along the curve of Spirit Lake. Those are beautiful words, harmony, spirit. And on that deck, the mountain is right there across the water. It almost doesn't look real the way it rises up so majestic, so powerful, bigger than anything around it by far, its own image rippling in the lake. It's strange the way something large and dangerous can almost make you feel safe until it doesn't. It's strange the way you can stare straight at it and know what it is, but still ignore the warnings. Everything we have, I say. I rock and sway with the baby on my hip. I named him Will because that's what you need to survive the world. One of his little socks is falling off, and I scoot it back up his chunky leg. I lean into him and smell the sticky peach scent of his cheeks. You don't just walk away from that. My husband doesn't like being told what to do. We've had the same conversation countless times. He leans back in his Adirondack chair. It's a beautiful morning, so why not? Spring. You can smell blackberries ripening in the deep water murkiness of the lake. His breakfast plate sits on the ground next to him, just bits of egg left, the overcooked parts, the thin skin from the sides of the pan, the slightly burnt edges of toast. He leaves behind the flawed parts like a child would. It seems quiet, I say, watching that mountain. It looks quiet. On my hip, Will jabbers his pretend talk, and I gaze at him, and he gazes back with his endless universe eyes. I tell him things that are only between us, secret stuff. Like the lie that I just spoke, because I don't think it looks quiet, not for 1 second. I can feel something building down in the core, down in the dark parts no one can see. Silence isn't to be trusted, not that kind. For weeks now, I've seen that muscle working in Sean's neck, tightening, relaxing, tightening. I caught him pacing and going stony, and I thought, uh-oh. I thought, it's coming. Sometimes eruptions aren't as personal as they seem. They're collision forces that have little to do with you. Stress, pressure, some instability that begins at the center and rises slowly to the surface. It's fine. Goddamn, Dixie Lee Ray and her red zones. They told us Three Mile Island was the end of the world, too. If we took off, we'd have looters. Exactly, I say. But I don't really believe the Andelis had looters. I think the door was open because they left in a hurry. That door was open because nothing inside mattered all that much at the end of the day. All up and down Spirit Lake, those shingled houses, those charming little retreats, they're empty now. With the neighbors gone, I feel it more. The way the evergreens tower overhead, and the way the shady spots can get so cold, and the way the dark out there was deeper than any city dark. Exactly was a lie, too. It was helpful all the years of practice, saying the things you needed to say to keep the mood even, keep feeding tidbits to his ego, turning down the temperature with your words. It was helpful to learn how to manipulate. The Kitsap Sun today? They said scientists who watch the mountain for a living aren't promising much of a show. See, I say. Inside, I wrestle that baby and change him, the little squirming, twisting guy. I smooch his bare belly. It's weird because there's doom, doom everywhere, the heavy sense of imminent danger, but I feel glee. I feel giddy the way you do when something's almost over, or something's almost starting. I try to take it all in, the crib with its rabbit bumper pads, the plants along the kitchen sill, the windows where you can see the fog roll in. But everything seems slippery, impossible to hold in memory. I'm too jittery with nerves, maybe. Or maybe sweet thoughts refuse to keep company with the others. The cowering in that corner. The hole punched in the wall over there. And, in that room, his hand striking again and again as his face contorted in fury. I zip the keys to the truck into my pocket. The baby naps, a small warm hump, diapered bottom up in the air, soft feather hair damp with sleep. I can hear him, Sean, chopping wood in the back, you know, for winter, for the future. I peek at him through the blinds. He has his Walkman clipped to his belt, his headphones on, probably the same cassette he listens to over and over. My Sharona. I can tell by the rhythm of the thump-thump crack of the axe. I, woo! I grab the important papers, the clothes, the diapers, though damn, babies come with so much stuff. I prop open the front screen with a rock so it doesn't bang shut. The chopping stops. I freeze because no lie will cover this, what's gathered in my arms. The chopping starts again. I shove what I can under the seats. That night, after Johnny Carson, he falls asleep on the couch. Dangerous, right in the living room. That mountain isn't going to wait for safe, though, and so I lift the baby, a heavy weight against my shoulder. I go out that front door and I shut it carefully, and then I run. I run to the truck, and my heart is beating like crazy, and I'm going so fast I lose a flip-flop in the grass. I toss Will into his little bucket. My hands are shaking so bad I can barely get the key in, then rrrr, like a bad horror movie. It is one that began too long ago, when I was a lifetime younger. Oh, my little pretty one, my pretty one. Ooh. The engine turns and I hit the gas and we're down the road and we're speeding under a midnight sky past those shingled houses now empty. We're flying past Harmony Falls and the old lodge and we're taking the curves of Spirit Lake, the moon shining white, glittering the lake water as that mountain looms. We drive the logging roads, the ones that go around the barricades set up weeks ago, keeping people out, keeping people in. It's so dark and the roads are rough. We pass the Iron Creek campground and go over the bridge, and we're on Highway 12, but my eyes are on the rearview mirror the whole time because I'm sure he's back there, following me in his dying Mustang. Every pair of headlights is him, I'm sure of it. I feel him, or maybe I just feel that mountain, inhaling, exhaling. Any headlights back there merge into a steady stream on I-5. What's everyone doing up so late? Who knows, but we're checking into the River Inn in Chehalis. I have one shoe, but the woman says nothing. Shame floods in. Behind that locked door, I make a call. We made it, I tell my brother. My eyes burn with fatigue. A heart can't pound that hard and for that long without needing rest. Even here between those pine musty and unfamiliar sheets, with the baby beside me, I still feel him hovering. Finally, I drift into sleep. The blast almost knocks me out of bed. The explosion, the boom, is terrible, atomic. The walls tremble. The lamp swings on its chain. There's no doubt what's finally happened. Will starts to cry and I pick him up. It's okay, I tell us. The first thing I see when I bring Will out onto that stoop of the River Inn is a pair of sandals. They're formed to someone else's feet, but they're pointing out. My chest heaves with grief and gratitude and my throat tightens with tears. It's eerie silent outside. The birds are silent, the trees are. I swear the river is, and the sky is a crazy, end-of-the-world violet bruise. I hope he was there. I hope he was in that house. I hope the lava flowed over him and stilled his body and his arms and his voice. I hope it buried him. Now it begins to snow, gray snow falling, ash-like snowflakes. I let out a breath. I exhale. I want to sob with horror and relief and awe. I tilt my head up toward the sky. I watch the snow coming down. It's almost beautiful. Inside that pine-walled room, with its cigarette-burned dresser and flowered bedspread kicked to the floor, the phone rings. It rings and rings until I reach it. He's been calling, my brother says, calling everyone. I remember those headlights. It's like he's back from the dead, but of course, he was never dead. 520 tons of ash is darkening the sky, steadily moving across the whole country. The waters of Spirit Lake boil, and the river thunders with mud, and the trees are incinerated. Rubble, wreckage, anything once living is singed and sizzling. The damage will last for years and years. The damage will last through generations. But that mountain, it's still here, isn't it? There's a giant hole where it blew, but it's here. Sometimes nothing wrecks the thing that destroys everything else. It alone will shake the ashes from itself and go on. It will stay and stay and stay standing. Only now we understand what it's capable of doing. In those sandals, I carry the baby to the truck to find some place where the sky isn't black. Harmony, spirit, those beautiful words, they're gone. But Will is still here in my arms.
That was Maureen Hager reading Deb Colletti's short story, Volcanic, published as part of the Spokesman Review's Summer Stories short fiction series this year. This is The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio. Our next story on this year's theme, which is Mount St. Helens, is by Spokesman Review outdoor editor Eli Frankovich. Here's Spokane Public Radio's chief engineer, Jerry Olson, reading The Department of Long-Term Catastrophes by Eli Frankovich.
The Department of Long-Term Catastrophes by Eli Frankovich. Hugh Hubert, the proprietor, founder, and sole employee of Hubert & Sons Long-Term Catastrophes, sat at a grimy table and tried not to smile. He asked, "Have you considered volcano insurance?" The client, a spindly dark-haired man named Jake, shook his head. The two men sat in a bland, damp room on the second floor of a strip mall in Kalama, Washington, along the banks of I-5, within a stone's throw of the turgid Columbia River. It was a balmy 65-degree January day. The accumulated ice from a cold snap 2 days prior had nearly melted. Its legacy water pooled along the town's main drag. "It's a new bundle we offer," Hubert said. "Packages a lot of the traditional catastrophe business coverage into a bulletproof deal. Flood, earthquake, projectile damage, you name it. We call it the Johnston Guarantee." Hubert had made the 35-minute drive from Portland earlier that morning. It was a beautiful day, the sky a brilliant blue and the sun warm. Although the northern horizon was hazy, steam ejected ash lingering from last week's mini-eruption, the news said. Jake owned a small business transferring ancient VR memories to the latest bioformat, or something like that, Hubert couldn't remember, and had called him a few weeks ago, struggling timidly to tell his story. He needn't have wasted the effort. Hubert had heard it 100 times, probably even thousands. "I used to just have regular normal insurance. Seems to work fine, but now, I don't know. I feel like nothing is covered. Blah, blah." In Jake's case, it was a series of floods last spring, followed shortly by a deep freeze. The water pooled up to a foot deep on the floor of his shop, froze solid. The insurance agency, God bless them, only paid out half, claiming most of the damage came from the ice, not the flood, and after all, Jake hadn't purchased the ice storm coverage. Now Jake was visibly nervous. his leg bouncing up and down like a rodeo clown. He was worried about his husband and daughter, he said. Hubert nodded along. But I mean, Jake said, how likely is a volcano? Hubert suppressed a carnal victory smile, instead leaning back in the chair and interlacing his fingers behind his head, letting his gut erupt over his belt in celebration of an imminent deal.
Have you seen the news? He asked. The scientists think Mount St. Helens could blow any day now.
Later, as Hubert sat in the back seat of his car navigating Portland's rush hour traffic, he felt a tinge of guilt. The volcano package, for Jake at least, was probably unnecessary, although technically defensible. Kalama, after all, wasn't more than 50 miles from the mountain, and with the 90th anniversary of its last big eruption nearing, the probability of another blow-up was rising, although most experts agreed it was still a decade or more away. And, Hubert guessed, Jake wouldn't be in business for another 5 years. In his decades working insurance, he developed a sense for a business in a death spiral. He shook the guilt away. He'd rather not dwell on it. It was the nature of his business, and it treated him well. Catastrophes of all kinds were a growth industry. Sure, he did the normal stuff, floods, burglary, and fire, but he'd managed to find his niche early on. Climate change and its harem of horrors, artificial intelligence, job displacement, too, meteor strikes, even. With the discovery of other sentient life 2 years ago, they had been sending Earth messages for nearly 100 years, but for various inane and complicated reasons, NASA had been interpreting the signals as reruns of Friends. Hubert was in the process of drafting a policy covering an interstellar war and/or subjection. He might even draft a separate policy for extraterrestrial job displacement. He took a mental note to check and see what the competition was doing in that sphere. Things changed faster than anyone could track. Technology, of course, but also topology. Seattle had calved into the sea in 2040 when Hubert was 20. The weather shifted year to year. All this change, Hubert learned, made everyone very, very afraid. When in a philosophical mood, he believed people didn't actually fear death or financial ruin so much as chaos. Insurance, even in the topsy-turvy world of the 70s, remained a bulwark against mayhem. He believed that without a tinge of doubt. His car arrived and parked itself in the garage. The lights flickered on and the door opened. The house greeted him, asked him about his day, informed him dinner would be ready in 20 minutes, and that it had successfully killed 3 mice. Was that a note of pride? Tremors had knocked a few knick-knacks off the mantel. He noticed and put them back, the picture of Mom and Dad, his brother. He sat in the living room and checked his statistics. Slightly elevated heart rate, above average water consumption, below average caloric intake, stable cortisol levels. His MD assistant shipped the day's data to his insurance company. The silence was oppressive, and he felt some dark mood coming on. Sensing this, the house put on music, an individually tailored mix of melancholy and upbeat pop designed to honor his internal state while slowly lightening the mood. He adjusted his dopamine levels, welcoming the familiar luminosity, a general aloofness that softened the worries and stresses of the day. He rested there for some time, but his mind, impervious to the comfort of the situation, wouldn't let go of something Jake had said. They'd been saying their goodbyes. Jake had put up an admirable show of pretending he would think it through, even though they both knew he was terrified and would happily pay for any modicum of peace of mind.
I'll let you know soon, Jake said.
No rush, Hubert replied while glancing at the water-stained carpet. Hopefully it'll be a mild spring.
Jake looked miserable. The room smelled awful, damp and cold. It wasn't even hooked up to the internet. Hubert started out the door.
It must be nice to own a business with your sons, Jake said.
Hubert stopped, his hand resting on the door frame.
Yeah, he said. Talk to you soon, Jake.
Winona had been gone for 5 years, but he still sometimes heard her voice in the home they'd shared. He'd barely touched her office. It had, over the years, become a shrine to their love. Anything and everything that reminded him of her, he'd moved into that room, slowly filling it. He didn't enter it much. They'd met during a career retraining program. He was 32 at the time. His first career had just ended. He'd worked for Apple in tech support before they folded. And she was the course teacher. He'd never in his life felt any stronger sense, good or bad, about the rightness of things. In his experience, people who talked like that were usually woo-woo wackos who'd willingly forego dopamine boosters in order to get closer to reality. He had no time for that, and yet, when he saw her that first day in downtown Portland, he was overcome by a deep knowing that they were meant to be. That had been foreign, terrifying, exhilarating, and completely irrational territory. He was smitten. And as they became closer, all the evidence supported his initial feeling. They fit. She balanced out his cynicism. Her job, after all, dealt in hope, and his caustic view of life provided an edge. He liked to think, at least, that helped her connect with the desperate people cycling through her classrooms. She later said she hadn't felt a similar knowing, but it didn't seem to matter. Their lives seamlessly interlocked, and within 6 months they'd moved in together, a decision his friends warned against. But it went well. For 13 years, they'd had an ideal partnership. And then she'd become pregnant. He still remembers that day viscerally and completely. He was in Alaska trying to sell crop insurance. "Sure, it's too cold now, but just look at the models. This will be the freaking breadbasket of the world in 20 years, brother. Think about your children," when he got the call. He called her back as soon as the meeting was over. Before the video even popped up, he could tell something was wrong. She sounded tense and tight, a cable stretched too far. "I'm pregnant." He almost laughed. That was impossible, right? Apparently not. Only later did he learn that the male pill, while nearly perfectly effective, was not infallible. He couldn't believe it. They'd had people living on the moon, and the Mars mission was about to launch, and yet the pill still failed? It strengthened his resolve to avoid space travel at all costs. Adding to the seeming impossibility of the entire thing was the fact that Winona was 48 years old. On the flight back from Alaska, he figured out the rough probability of getting pregnant under those conditions. Statistically speaking, they'd won the freaking lottery. He even started drafting an unexpected pregnancy despite Best Efforts insurance plan, but the potential market was just too small to make it pencil out. That night, they'd met at their favorite restaurant and then walked along the Willamette River. "What are we going to do?" she'd asked. Despite the shock of the day, he'd felt happy. The pregnancy made sense. Their relationship felt ordained, a crazy word to be using, and yet how he felt. He told her this shyly. She started crying. They hugged. He cried, discreetly. They were going to be parents. "Twin boys," the doctor intoned, examining the black and white and oddly antique-looking ultrasound. "Holy crap," she said. "Holy crap," he said. They made preparations. In a fit of exuberance, he renamed his business. She laughed and said he was sweet. Australia burned, and desperate people arrived in boats and planes up and down the Pacific coast. The insurance business boomed. Then one day in early May, Winona, who still worked for the government helping people retrain for new careers, came home from work ashen. It had been a tough day, a class full of folks in their 70s trying to get jobs in biotech. Some were refugees from the East Coast. They smelled of desperation, she said. "Want a dopamine shot?" he asked. She shook her head no. "Hugh, I've been thinking," she paused. Looked out the window, fear gnawed at his belly, and he upped his dopamine level. He felt at peace and calm ready for whatever she would say next. "I don't think we should have these babies." The words cut despite his elevated happiness index. "Seeing those people in my class today, I just don't feel right about having a kid, especially not two of them," she said. "Everything is so bad right now. Can you imagine what it would be like when they're 70? She couldn't imagine bringing a kid, let alone two of them, into this mess. She was crying. He was crying. They went back and forth. She wanted it to be their decision, she said, and he believed her. But of course, the biological reality made it her decision more than his, didn't it? And her logic was bulletproof, he admitted. So at the end, they made the rational choice. They still loved each other, and they were committed to each other, they said. The pregnancy didn't change that, they said. but of course it did. The fault lines widened. He searched in vain for some insurance against that, something that would hem them back together, and he didn't change the name of his company, saying at first that it was more hassle than it was worth, and soon saying nothing at all. Jake called the next day. "I've been thinking it over, and I'd like to add the volcano package," he said. "I did some reading last night, and whoa, I had no idea volcanoes were so dangerous. That one in the 1900s, or whenever, that was insane. I saw some of the photos." 20 minutes later, it was done. Hubert was a little wealthier, and Jake felt more secure. Still, after he got off the phone, that same dark, empty mood overcame him, and he felt none of the normal post-deal surge of power and accomplishment. Perhaps he was getting too old for this, he thought. He prepared for the day's meeting. He was dressing, trying not to think too much, when a tremor raced through the house, the floor suddenly fluid. He stumbled and steadied himself on the dresser. He heard a crash from Winona's office, and the house started squawking at him. Another tremor shook the world. "Seek shelter! Seek shelter!" More crashes from the room. He tried to run but was tossed into the wall, nearly lost his footing but didn't fall. The house yelled at him. "Volcano warning! Ash! Earthquakes expected! Seek shelter, Hubert!" The floor settled, for a moment, and he lunged toward her office door, opening it and bracing himself in its frame. Another shock rocked the house. Already her room was a disarrayed disaster. The photos of her and him smashed on the floor, and her workstation toppled. A box full of her clothes broken open, its contents tossed about like driftwood. The tremors stopped. The ground, so fluid a moment ago, returned to its normal solidity. He stood there on the edge of the wrecked room and felt himself unraveling. He roughly wiped away at the tears welling in his eyes and turned his mind to work and his back to the room. He didn't know the extent of the volcanic damage, of course, but based on the back-of-the-envelope math, he'd owe a lot of people a lot of money if he didn't get creative.
That was Jerry Olson, reading The Department of Long-Term Catastrophes by Eli Frankovich. You've been listening to The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio. If you want to listen back to this episode or last week's Spokesman Review Summer Stories, subscribe to The Bookshelf podcast or find us at SpokanePublicRadio.org. You can also read the full Summer Stories series at spokesman.com. We'll be back tomorrow with more short fiction from this year's Summer Stories by authors Tiffany Midge and Neil Thompson. For Spokane Public Radio, I'm Chris Messini.